Guys, welcome to another episode of The Pulse. And this one is, I mean, they're all fun. I enjoy doing this all the time. But I was just joking with our next guest that I've been whistling, singing, humming her songs all day ever since we confirmed the interview. It is my pleasure to be joined by musician and author and so much more, Sheila E. Welcome to The Pulse.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I appreciate you taking the time to do this. Do you hear that a lot? I told you I've been walking around all day and I'm humming parts of your songs, and then people I walk by are finishing the song with me.
That's awesome. That's a good thing. A hit is a hit.
That's something that you hear a lot, that people are, you know, they'll sing your songs back to you, even, you know, even now.
Oh no, absolutely. It's a wonderful thing to hear. It really is. You know, when you first write something coming into the business and someone actually knows your song, that's this huge honor, you know? And then when you go to perform and you see an entire audience singing your song, like the lyrics, and, you know, dancing to the music, that's what you want. You want them to remember those songs.
So we were talking about, before we got started, I was mentioning to you that I've had the opportunity to interview a couple of actors, and they go back and forth with that. Some of them are like, I don't want to be known as Urkel, you know, forever, you know, right. But you're known for something. From your perspective, even if it's a handful of songs that they know, even though they know a long career, that's still a good thing?
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah, because I've been doing this for so long. I'm actually celebrating this year. This is my 50th year as a professional musician. I
Wow.
turned professional when I was 15 years old. So I just turned 65 and I'm celebrating 50 years. And if you think about all that I've done, I mean, there's so much, and that people are still honoring me in that way. This is a blessing.
Okay, so happy anniversary, I guess, as you continue to celebrate. That's amazing.
Thank you.
That's amazing.
Absolutely.
People know you for different things. And we talked about some of the songs. You've been in a few movies. You have book. You do tours and philanthropy. But you go back as a musician long before some of the stuff that people may have initially known. Tell us how you got into it initially, because you're a musical family.
Yeah, my dad, Pete Escovedo, who the legendary Latin jazz artist, he's still performing now, actually, and just shot a new video. He's 87 years young, and he's still going at it, so I hope to be like him. I have two brothers that play as well, Juan and Peter Michael, and I have a sister, Zena, who mostly dances, choreographs, and my mom sings and plays a little bit. We grew up in the business, so... it's interesting because a lot of people ask, like, how was it for you to, like, play in front of an audience? But growing up in the business, watching my dad play, watching him perform, him in the living room, him listening to LPs, vinyl, every single day practicing to the artist that he loved, music was around us all the time. And when we would have gatherings, family gatherings, or they would have jam sessions at the house, there were tons of people in our living room all the time, like throughout the week. And so performing for our family, for performing for friends, we grew up in that environment, and listening and playing and growing up in production and watching my dad, how he treats and respects his musicians and how he was a leader, and my mom as well. And coming from a place of, oh, you know, we don't have tech, so my dad's like, you know, rolling up the cables, and this is how you mic a drum. And growing up in it, how can you not be a part of that world?
You know? Yeah. And before the kind of the hits as a solo artist, and before all of that happened, like, you had already worked with Marvin Gaye and Lionel Richie and Diana Ross and Herbie Hancock. So somebody and Prince, and we'll get to that at some point, but when they come to you, that wasn't a big, well, I guess it's always a big deal, but it wasn't like your first introduction to the industry.
No, and that's why I didn't really answer the question, like, you know, I mean, getting started, yes, but growing up in the business, you meet people. My dad met Tito Puente, who became my godfather, when they were like 18 or 19 years old, something like that. I thought it was 15, but I think it was 18 or 19. And then you had these artists, these legendary Latin jazz artists coming to our home. And then growing up in the Bay Area, you have the Whispers coming over and hanging out. You have Lou Rawls and all these people. And you're growing up, my dad's in Santana. And then you have the Pointer Sisters and then Sly Stone and Gramps and Josephson, Tower Power. Then you're around all these people growing up in that environment. But yeah, when someone comes to you, you start playing professionally, and then someone comes up and says, hey, you know, I want to produce you and your dad. Billy Cobham comes to see us at a show in San Francisco. And that started my first time ever being in a studio performing and recording with my dad, with Billy Cobham. And then it continued, then meeting George Duke, going out on tours, George Duke, meeting all of these other people that we were on these huge festivals that they do like they do now. When I was able to meet on these festivals and then end up playing with different people like Ashford and Simpson, George Benson, and at the time, LTD. And you meet all of these cool artists, and then one day someone comes and says in 1982, hey, Marvin Gaye wants you to play the tour with you, wants you to play his tour, and you don't have to come and audition. Like, really? How does that happen?
That's amazing.
Putting in the work, and asking and begging people when no one knew who I was, can I sit in? Can I play? I would love to. And they're like, you're a girl, you know, yes. All of that stuff.
Well, but it's interesting you bring that up, because I was reading, always doing research before we do the interviews. And in one of your interviews, you were talking about the fact that, and statistically, only 10% of the professional drummers or people who make it to the level that you have, if there are levels to this, only 10% were women. Now, that was a few years back, but the statistic still speaks to the fact that this was a hard door for women to open.
Well, definitely. I mean, me growing up in the era that I did, there weren't very many percussion players at all. The only woman that I saw play drums and percussion was Karen Carpenter, because her and her brother, they had their own variety show. My mom plays a little bit, but growing up in the environment of the Bay Area, they always had drum circles. So there were drum circles in Berkeley and then some places in the Mission District in San Francisco. And people would just call each other, hey, we're going to the park this Saturday. Everyone's going to come and jam. Everyone would pick up some sort of hand percussion and play and just jam. But professionally, Bobby Hall was the only other woman that I knew of that played. And at the time, I didn't know anyone else, even though I'm learning more and more that there were other women that we just didn't hear of. But growing up and playing percussion and drums, I didn't know any that were doing what I was doing.
Did it create a situation as you became, and obviously at 15, you probably didn't embrace that, but as you became more of, you know, a well-known individual, did you own the fact that you were kind of a trailblazer and had to show, you know, these young women that you can do this too?
I'm still learning. I'm not at that point yet. Okay. I'm still working my way through things and learning and inspired by all the young women and young girls who are playing out. Man, I don't know if I was that good that young, but it's so inspiring to see them. And as much as I can, when I go on social media and I try to look up different people, or someone would send me something, and I would definitely DM the young lady or the young girl or their parents, because some of the people that I see are very young, like not even teenagers. And I DM their parents and say, congratulations, and I'm inspired by your child, and keep going and keep doing what you're doing. And if you ever need anything, just let me know. I'm doing this periodically throughout the week just to inspire and encourage them never to give up. I've talked to a lot of drummers, even some of the young male drummers that want to just give up, because it's like, you know, I'm not getting enough likes. And I'm like, but that's not why you're doing this. Do you do it because you really love music? Is this your passion? Because you're going to get a lot of no's. And that was part of my life, is getting no's constantly. But for me, no meant opportunity. It meant I had to figure out a way to get on stage. If it was one side said no, but I'd go into the back area and I'd, hey, can I sit in? Oh, yeah, come on. I'd find someone to let me get on that stage and play.
Just to get out there and continue to master the art and continue to get people to hear your sound. So I, again, in reading, that sounds like it was a blessing and a curse. It was a blessing because everybody got to hear your music, and it obviously led to a very successful career. If I'm reading correctly, it was a curse because you played so much and you were willing to give of your gift so much that you ended up on a bunch of stuff that you didn't get credit for.
Yeah, but that was accidental. I don't think it was purposeful, but okay. That happens sometimes. Sometimes there are artists, they have so many people playing on their records that stuff gets pushed to the side and you kind of go, oh shoot, I have the record and there's, my name's not on it. You know, That's happened a few times. For instance, Michael Jackson's Off the Wall. I met the Jacksons in 1977, I think, in Europe. And the whole family, we became friends. And but anyway, Michael calls Quincy calls and says, Michael's playing these sounds and making the sounds through his, of course, with his mouth. And I don't know what instrument it should be. So bring all your stuff. I go to the studio with tons of gear, of course. And I just figured, I'm known for just making percussion instruments with whatever I have, or if I see something, I'll just make it up. And I basically took two bottles, not like water bottles, but not plastic, but bottles. Uh-huh. And I poured water in them, and I took my, the little triangle, and I made sounds. So like on Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, that's, you hear me playing percussion. When you hear dun 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 dun, that vibe that you hear, it's really the bottles with water in it that I tuned to the song that made that track. And so then Michael calls me and says, "Hey, we're gonna have a autograph signing in Berkeley. Meet me there because I want you to come to the record store with me." I said, "Okay." So I meet him there with my little sister. And we show up, and I got there right before he did. And I get the album. I was like, I can't believe it. I'm on the record. I can't wait. Uh-huh. I can't wait to hear the rest of the music. And I looked, and it wasn't on there. So he walked in, people going crazy. And I said, my name's on the record. He goes, huh? What?
So he didn't know either.
No, he had no idea. No. So it just happened sometimes. There were a few other people that didn't get credit that were pretty famous at the time that got it just kind of didn't happen. So, but hey, I get, some royalties from that, so it's okay.
So it all worked out in the end.
It all worked out.
Regardless, no name, but the name's on the check. So ultimately, that's what matters then. So you're doing all of this, and you're kind of coming up through the ranks, and you've made your name as a drummer, as a musician, and what have you. How did the discovery and the launching of your solo album, first one, how that happen?
Of the solo album, I met Prince in 77, cutting to years later, playing with, in 83, playing with Lionel Richie. And at the time, Prince kept coming out to the shows and everything. And then Prince said, he was doing all these other records. And he just said, you want to do your own record now? And I said, yeah, he knew that already because I had tons of, back then, cassettes full of music, and that's how we used to listen to everything. And so he had a production deal. I signed his production deal, and we went in the studio and did my first record. Probably within a week, we went to Sunset Sound. I was already recording with them at the time, and so we did the record and did Glamorous Life. And before you know it, I started my own band, put together everything in San Francisco. And then I booked a tour with same management. We had the same management team. And the great thing about this is I started in Europe. The plan was to break the record in Europe first, so that by the time we would come back to the States, it would have been a hit in Europe. And when we get to the States, we would be opening for Prince for the Purple Rain tour. And it just all flowed. But it was probably the hardest work I had ever done was prior to going out on tour, is to do these, back then in Europe, we just went from one country to another doing promo. I did every single publication you could think of, every single magazine. The list of just interviews was up to almost 6 to 8 hours a day every day. I mean, it was exhausting, but yeah. we really worked hard, and I involved the band in being a part of it so they could understand what this meant, if they even wanted to be a solo artist, to see how much work it was. But I mean, there were times we didn't sleep for days. It was just so much, because sometimes we would end up most of the nights performing after doing interviews, and that would consist of us starting at 11 o'clock, sometimes midnight, and stopping at 3, and then we have a flight at 5 a.m. So
it doesn't sound like you loved that part.
That's the work. The fun part is the reward and being able to get on stage performing music for people and them loving what you do. It's a lot of work. It's really not as easy as people think it is. But what you put in is what you get out. And I love, working and coming up with ideas and growing as an artist and a musician. And it's just a lot of fun. It's my passion. It's my love. And I'm just grateful to be able to do it.
So let's talk about that. You're touring now. You're going to be in Philly at the City Winery in February, but you're continuing to tour around. Do you still love it? I mean, I feel like I look at your social media and videos now, and you're still standing up and playing the drums and singing and performing. Do you love it now?
Nothing has changed from the first time that I realized that this is what I wanted to do, which I wasn't going to be a musician. Once I realized that this is it, this is amazing, I feel every time I get on this stage, it is the first time I'm ever playing. And the butterflies, the nervousness, the excitement, I mean, I wouldn't change that for anything. I think that the day that ever, if it does disappear, then I know that it's time for me to stop. And I hope that never happens. I love it. The hardest part, the most challenging part of doing what I do is really the traveling, the no sleep, by the time we get somewhere and then the setup and, it's all of that. But the reward really is being on stage and the people loving, the family loving what we get to do.
You love the performance, still love the performance, even as you're celebrating all that time. But I want to take a step back for a minute, because you wrote a book, a memoir, The Beat of My Own Drum, a few years back, and kind of told some of the stories of things that weren't necessarily the performance and the fun part of it. Why? Why'd you decide to do that after that much time?
Oh, well, I mean, I knew growing up that one day I would end up sharing my testimony and sharing things, because it really is something that is important to a lot of people that I meet, and them asking me questions. And once I explain to them some of the things that I've gone through, as an artist, or as a musician, as a songwriter, whatever it may be, and even personal, I realized it had blessed so many people. And I'm like, well, this is part of my testimony, which means I should be sharing. This gift is not for me to hold just for me. It's my gift that has been given to me is for everyone else. Mm-hmm. And so if and vulnerable, which a lot of people don't like to be, you get to share your experiences, which actually blesses and encourages and possibly inspires others.
You shared some serious things. You shared sexual assault as a child. You shared some of the behind the scenes situations that have gone on. You shared relationships. How did people respond to that? And did you get what you expected, or you just kind of get the response and go forward with it?
Oh, no. It opened up a door that, again, telling my testimony of the things that had happened to me at 5 years old, being raped and going through that and the damage that it caused. But also, when I step into a room and I know I'm going to talk about it, once I speak that, you can see the entire room. Everyone's in shock, first of all. But then there are a lot of people that I can definitely go, I see you've been through something you've been through. There's more than half of a room, no matter if it's 10 people or 5,000 people, more than half of the room have been abused some kind of way, either mentally, spiritually, physically. Someone has been abused. And when I talk about that, it opens up a door where I say to them, listen, if you're in a relationship or have been or something that you're going through, you have to share, you have to tell someone. Because the things that we hold in, if we hold these things, we're never going to grow. We're never going to be able to live our lives fully. And these kinds of things, when people are scared to talk about it, these kinds of things create sickness. And it kills us, and mentally as well as physically. It kills us. It destroys our bodies, and it destroys our minds. So if we're allowed to not be ashamed, but know that we're ashamed, we're carrying this, being ashamed, scared, frightened, all of these things that are not healthy, that if you share that, it then all of a sudden you're going to open up this thing where you're peeling off the opening up and peeling the onion, and things are falling off of you because now you're not carrying all these things. Now you're allowed to live your life in your fullest because you want to be free. Yeah. And it is so important. It saves lives.
You had some experiences. So what, your first love, as you defined it, Carlos Santana?
Yeah.
So you talked about, that was your first love. You talked about your love for Prince. And I saw an interview where you said that you were actually surprised that, you know, "I was briefly engaged to Prince" was the thing that people most responded to. You're like, wait, there's other stuff out there in here. It surprised you, the response to it?
I mean, a little bit. I think some people expected it, but I think they were more shocked about Carlos's, me being with Carlos Santana. I think that was the, it wasn't Prince, it was more so Carlos. Yeah.
Okay.
There, the book was 300 pages, I think, and I had more than 300 pages, so there could be a part two.
Okay.
We'll see.
There's more to talk about?
Oh, there's so many. Yeah, there's much to share.
Much to share. The theory of our show is a concept of use your voice for good. And in doing some of your research, I saw you've been involved with philanthropy for years, musical instruments to schools in Oakland and Elevate Hope Foundations. Tell me about your commitment to that and why it's important to you.
Well, it was Elevate Hope, but we changed it to Elevate Oakland because we actually brought it back, the foundation, to the Bay Area, Oakland, California, where I grew up. And myself, Lynn Mabry, my singer, who's also from the Bay Area, Jason Hoffman, and Yoshi, who actually owns one of the best clubs in the Bay Area. And we pulled both of our foundations together and our resources to start Elevate Oakland. And what we do is we use local artists in the Bay Area when they're perhaps not working and utilize them to help teach some of the classes and either maybe even assist with the teacher in the history of maybe it's, you know, jazz or the history of hip hop or learning how to DJ, or they want to learn how to sing, you know, or play instruments. So we provide that for them. And what happened was Lynn and I had started our foundation many, many years ago. We started in foster care because we had both similar situations growing up and kids who have been abused in some sort of way. We felt like we could be their voices. And we felt that a lot of the kids in foster care needed music, needed the opportunity to have this presented to them, because we know how important and how healing music is, that it helped us to get through what we went through. Why not try that with the kids in foster care? So we started there. But then when we went to Oakland, we found out that the need was so great for the students wanting music. They wanted to play. They wanted to learn how to sing, all of these things that deal with music and the arts, painting, photography, all of that, videography. And a lot of the schools in the Bay Area stopped their arts and their sports, different things that is unfortunate, but that's the thing that the kids want the most. So we went to the schools, and we didn't go through the system. What we did was we went individually to each school, talking to the principal to say, we're presenting this curriculum for your kids during regular class hours. It's not an after school. This should be common and it should be in schools every day.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's what we did. So Elevate Oakland provides that for the students.
I know that we've got a little bit more time, so I want to get a couple more questions. Again, we mentioned the show's coming up. What are we going to get from a Sheila E. show when we come and see the performance now?
Well, the E-Train, Sheila E. and the E-Train is a band that I started in the 90s because I wanted to play drums in my own band more so than just playing percussion. So I'm actually the drummer in my own band, which I love. And it's kind of like, I would say maybe jazz funk music.
Okay.
And that's why I'm showing you the CD right here.
Okay.
It's called Sheila E. and the E-Train, Hella Funky, the funk and the E. That's what we're talking about. Yeah. And the band members are on there. And it's really cool. Like the Bay Area, it's all about Oakland. But it's also, you know, growing up playing music, new music. We're giving tribute to a couple of artists on here as well. And the great thing about this is everything that you're hearing on this record, we're playing live. That's why we're inspired to do this. And not only that, this record is not coming out until March. I'm not streaming it until March. So what we're doing is all of these shows, all the City Winery shows that we're playing up until the end of February, starting this week, you can only buy the CD at the show. So
okay.
You have to come to the show to get this.
Okay. So again, exclusive when they come see the City Winery show. Two more things quickly, and we will go ahead and wrap up. So we have, and I guess we kind of end with that whole concept of use your voice for good. You know, you've talked about a lot of different ways that you do that, but what does use your voice for good mean for you?
Wow. I mean, bottom line really is we were created to love each other. We're created to, I feel created to love each other. And if we love in a place of really loving someone, then there should not be any animosity and hate and all of the things that are not of good. And if we loved unconditionally the way that we should, then all of those things go away. We're all human beings. And I just think in supporting each other and lifting each other up, loving each other, inspiring each other, encouraging, doing as much as you can. I mean, I always say, even in the shows, if you come to the shows, but I say that if we utilize the word love together as we should, so many things that we can do together as a family can change the things that is happening or that are happening in our world today. And I ask everyone to turn to someone next to them who they don't know, a stranger, look them in the eyes and say, I love you. And it breaks that wall down, and someone in that room needed to hear someone say that I love you. And mm-hmm. we've heard about saving lives during the performance, that it saved someone's life just by a stranger turning to say, I love you. So that's using our voice to love someone is really important.
That's where we leave it. I appreciate you taking the time out. I didn't even mention, I'm going to take a Sheila E. masterclass. I want to learn how to play the drums. You think you could even help me out?
Oh yeah. The masterclass is fairly easy. You take it, you start in the kitchen. You start in the kitchen. That's the easy. Oh, and I do want to say this, talking about starting in the kitchen, because it all started in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
July 12th, this year, 2023, I'm receiving my star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Oh, congratulations.
July 12th.
That's
yes.
Awesome. That's around my birthday. Maybe I'll come out there.
Come on down. Whoever's around, we're going to announce it. But July 12th.
That's awesome. Yeah. Congratulations. Yeah. I'm going to go back to singing songs around the newsroom and see who else continues to sing along with me. I appreciate you taking the time with us, and I wish you continued success. We'll see you at City Winery.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, take care. Guys, thank you so much for listening to The Pulse with Bill Anderson. Today with Sheila E., The Glamorous Life. Yeah, I was feeling a little corny, but that's what I was doing all day as I walked around our studios here in Philadelphia. Remember to hit subscribe so that you'll get notification every time a new episode of The Pulse comes out. That's every Monday. If you're in Philadelphia and you would like to watch the show on TV, you can check it out on Fox 29. Also nationally on Fox Soul. You'll enjoy it. You can look at all of the past episodes that have aired previously on YouTube. So check that out. I leave you today, as I always do, reminding you that whenever you can, use your voice for good. And have a good one.